Today on Wings, Canada's National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women, and its place in the 16 Days Against Gender Violence.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The idea of marking 16 days of activism against violence against women originated during an international conference in the U.S., convened by the Center for Women's Global Leadership in 1991. November 25th, the first day of the campaign, had been a day of activism for Latin American women for a decade. It was the anniversary of the 1960 massacre of three sisters in the Dominican Republic who had organized the opposition against the dictator. December 10th, the last of the 16 days, is International Human Rights Day, the day the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was acclaimed at the United Nations. The UN declared November 25th the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women in 1999. But feminist activism has kept the entire 16 days in the public eye. Women report their worldwide activities to each other via community radio broadcasting, internet, film and video, and social media. As of 2010, the Center for Women's Global Leadership changed the campaign name to the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender Violence, but several variations of the name appear on different sites. Day 12 of the 16 days is especially marked in Canada. It is the anniversary of the Montreal Massacre, which took place December 6, 1989. Here's that story as first reported to Wings.
There were men and women inside the classroom. He asked or ordered the men to walk out of the classroom. Then he gathered the women in one side of the classroom and then shot six women there. He then went on the first floor into the cafeteria.
On December 6, 1989, a gunman claiming his life had been ruined by feminists killed 14 women in the École Polytechnique, the University of Montreal's engineering school, and then shot himself. The 14 victims were Genevieve Bergeron, age 21, Hélène Colgan, age 23, Nathalie Croteau, 23, Barbara Daigneau, 22, Anne-Marie Edward, 20, Maud Haviernick, 29, Barbara Maria Kluesnik, 31, Maryse Lagagnère, 25, Maryse Leclerc, 23, Anne-Marie Lemay, 27, Sonia Pelletier, 28, Michel Richard, 21, Annie Saint-Arnaud, 23, and Annie Turcotte, 21. Marc Lepine, who was born Gamel Garbi in Algeria to an Algerian father and a Quebecois mother, came to Canada with his family at the age of 7. His father was abusive and violent toward him, his mother, and sister, and his parents were eventually divorced. He later adopted his mother's maiden name. As Lepine walked calmly through three floors of the engineering building shooting at women, he shouted, "I hate feminists, I want the women, and if I can't be an engineer, neither can you." Police later revealed that Lepine had previously applied to the engineering school. The Concordia University Women's Union, along with the Université de Montréal Student Union, organized a candlelight vigil the evening after the shootings. Beth Blackmore of Radio Centreville's Matrix Collective was there.
Police estimated that there were 5,000 marchers carrying candles in the twilight, but media estimates were as high as 10,000. The march stopped outside the engineering school, where there was some tension for a few minutes when the first speaker, a woman from Concordia, a primarily Anglophone university, addressed the mostly French-speaking crowd in English. Then, when feminists tried to read a statement, they were stopped by a man from the U of M Student Union, who, in turn, was shouted at when he referred to those who had died using the masculine pronoun sur instead of the feminine celle. Emotions were rising, but when another woman, also a U of M student from the Commerce Department, came out of the crowd to the megaphone and pleaded for unity, people put aside their differences and continued the vigil in silence, marching to St. Joseph's Oratory for a silent meditation. In minus 20 degree weather, people needed to get indoors. but some Anglophone feminists preferred not to go to a church. The vigil ended after about half an hour in the oratory, with participants placing their candles on the altar before leaving.
Immediate public reaction was also, for the most part, split along gender lines. Most men, including journalists and politicians, said that this was an isolated act by a deranged personality. Most women expressed the belief that the killings were the result of society's tolerance of violence against women taken to the extreme. During the following days, however, the public, the media, and the politicians began to understand the feminist position. Gazette reporter Mary Lamy.
There was a large news meeting. Everyone who was available, all of the senior editors were there. And one of the senior editors said, the feminists are being very strident about this, which is always what they say when they don't like what we feminists have to say, and making accusations about misogyny and woman-hating and culture, in our culture. And I think we need to look into that and disprove it, if you know, because that's quite an allegation. And I said, well, I have a lot of connections in the women's community. I think I could look into that if you like. Because originally, I was slated to chase families, the families of the deceased, and get photos and stuff like that, you know, which is just the most distasteful thing. And so I managed to get this job of phoning feminist communities across the country and spokespersons to find out the feminist analysis. I felt quite fortunate that I work in a mainstream paper that may not have believed this... may not believe that misogyny exists, but was willing to look into it a bit because so many people were talking about it. I was very excited and very nervous and very agitated, but quite determined to be logical and level-headed and to write a story and get interviews and get quotes that were really, really solid so that it wouldn't sound like a bunch of crackpot women, you know, blowing off steam. I talked to women who were very articulate and intelligent and logical and wrote very articulate and intelligent and logical feminist analysis. Well, I mean, I didn't write, it wasn't because I was so brilliant. It was because I talked to people who were really, really good. And that ran on the front page of the weekly review of the Saturday paper. 250,000 Gazette readers got to read a feminist analysis of the shooting.
Women in Montreal felt devastated by these events and expressed their anger, frustration, and grief both publicly and privately. Women engineers were asked to wear white scarves on December 11th, the day of the public funeral for 10 of the victims. At a pro-choice rally held the day before, women attending were asked to wear pink armbands on December 11th to express solidarity with the women who died and with the feminist movement. Some Montreal feminists organized a women-only memorial held on December 13th, at which representatives of women's groups and individual women were invited to come up to the mic and express their feelings or read messages of solidarity. Women outside Montreal were also shocked and saddened by the killings. Women's groups in many cities held memorial services to honor the young women who died. Some women expressed the hope that this occurrence would not make us afraid to declare ourselves as feminists, but on the contrary, would serve to bring us together and strengthen our determination to continue this struggle. Reporting for Wings, this is Laura Yaros and Beth Blackmore in Montreal.
2 years after the massacre in 1991, Parliament declared December 6th as Canada's National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. Many different kinds of actions take place across the country. In 2012, in Vancouver, British Columbia, a Montreal Massacre Memorial event was held at the main library on Saturday, December 1st. It featured films, art exhibits, tabling by community groups, lectures and panels, and four roundtable discussions among feminist activists on topics of concern. The first roundtable was titled Naming, Shaming, and Calling the Police. How can we hold abusive men accountable? The moderator, Hilla Kerner, from Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, called attention to 100 silhouettes of women arranged throughout the venue. Each has a label describing what violence had happened to the woman and what action she took.
You probably could have seen, you probably saw the silhouettes across this room and other rooms. We have 100 silhouettes. They're a sample of our callers. It's a compiling of a 1 month worth of call of women telling their stories, calling to a women's group, to a Rape Crisis Center, Vancouver Rape Relief in our case. And only 17 of them choose to use the police, and only one case actually got thorough investigation, appropriate charges, and conviction. So the man was standing before a judge. One woman out of 100. So clearly we're not in a better shape at all in terms of getting police response. But we do know that when women's group are behind the individual women, when the police know that there is an advocate in the room, when the police know that there are women's group behind here, when we press with phone calls to the detective and to the supervisor and to the Crown, when we are in court, there is slight better response to the individual woman. So my next question is how, as women's group, we can improve police response to all women.
Rosa Elena Arteaga is manager of direct services and programs at Battered Women's Support Services. She explained to the roundtable that she sees increasing numbers of domestic violence cases where the police arrest the woman instead of the violent man. Here she tells what she's been doing about it.
I have seen an increase on women arrest, mainly with RCMP. That has been a huge issue. Not following the procedures, not acknowledging history of violence, who is the primary aggressor, coming to the incident and not asking the woman what happened, only hearing his side of the story. If the woman is immigrant, not providing interpreters, arresting her and treating her really worse than a man. I had a case where a woman was 4 days in jail. Mm-hmm. And at the end, we intervened and the charges were dropped. But she went through 4 days in jail, and we don't see men who sometimes leave women black and purple. They just stay a couple of hours, right? So what we have been doing, there was a police chief, and then the worker was saying, we have come across two cases where women call the police, and the police give a bad response. And I remember that this chief said, oh, not my people. So if you have the file number, if you have the name of the woman, then talk to me and then we can review that. So when I start noticing that women were being arrested as a result of the man who perpetrates violence calling the police, I start gathering the cases. So then I gathered 30 cases through 3 years. And then I have been analyzing the cases. What I found out is when we talk about racialized violence and how police choose who is the perpetrator, 60% of the women who were arrested were immigrant women who didn't speak English at the time and who actually they didn't even use violence, right? So we can talk also about why women self-protect, but in these cases they didn't even use violence. And in some cases later on the abuser confessed that he had made that up and he had injured himself, right? So through gathering those cases, we went to the different police detachments and we exposed what we were seeing, right? So they didn't have a way to say, oh no, not our people, right? So we did that. We also did several police complaints. We were successful with two. Mm-hmm. One, they said that they didn't make a mistake, so then we took it to the public commissions and we started talking to our networks, right? So I found out that in one of the detachments, it actually decreased the level and the number of women who were arrested, and we were very public about that. So I think that unfortunately we have the system and we have to challenge the system and we have to challenge and to make it accountable, but we also need to work together and expose the issue, because I remember that at that time I said, we have a problem with women being arrested, and an organization said, no, the problem is with dual arrest. And I said, give me the numbers. I want to know if there is dual arrest, right? So then there was a time that police, they said that they had pressure that they couldn't do dual arrest, so then they have to choose one. Of course, they chose the woman, right?
Yeah. Darla Goodwin is coordinator of Aboriginal Women's Services at Women Against Violence Against Women.
Just recently, over the last 5 years, we've been doing We have quite a bit of work and having conversations about holding men accountable to create change. And one of the things that we did was we brought a group of women together who serve Aboriginal women in the Greater Vancouver District, and we formed the Aboriginal Women's Working Group of the Greater Vancouver. And that working group put together the Downtown Eastside Smudge Ceremony to bring attention to the violence that women face, not just Aboriginal women, but all women in the country. And at those ceremonies, there was four of them, we called men forward, and specifically our chiefs, our hereditary and elected chiefs, as well as our medicine people or our helpers. And through that work, just recently, and actually today right now at the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Centre, Grand Chief Philip Lane is holding a talking circle to speak to the male responsibility to end rape and violence against Mother Earth and all the female side of life. So so that's part of what's going on. And we're also meeting actually this Monday to hold another circle where we're going to bring women together that work with the women in the community as well as survivors and the hereditary and the elected chiefs and our youth and all of our clan mothers, which are our matriarchs. And we're going to speak to the issue of, well, first of all, we're going to bring in the knowledge of what traditional roles of women were and how we were the leaders in our society and how before contact we didn't have violence against women and children and what that looked like and how that sort of society was maintained. And we're going to have that witnessed by the chiefs and the helpers or the medicine people as well as our youth to speak to the issues that we're facing today in community. So intimate partner relationships, sexual assault, every aspect of violence that women can face, whether it's economic or political. And to then have women bring forward the issues and have the matriarchs come forward and say what it is that they feel we need in our communities. And then we're going to ask those chiefs to stand up and make some kind of a pledge to hold government accountable for our women. And so those are the roles that we play as women in leadership. And we're calling upon all allies, not just our Aboriginal women, but to come and speak for the women that they work with. So that's a piece that we're doing.
Great, and we will come.
Oh, great.
Laura Robinson is a journalist and an athlete. She talked about what media could do to improve public knowledge about violence against women.
I'd like to pick up on what Suzanne said about the systemic way in which this continues to perpetuate. And I was here covering the Paralympics in 2010, and there was a little article in the Vancouver province that generally during the Olympics, crime went down. But then there was a little subtitle that it said, assaults and sexual assaults increase. Well, if you went to the VPD website, you would see that indeed, sexual assaults really increased in District 1 by 233%. There were no headlines about that. I mean, there were lots of headlines that, you know, the Canadian men's hockey team won the gold medal. Well, as I investigated more and more, getting statistics from places like Women Against Violence Against Women and Battered Women's Support Services, there was an increase in domestic violence, too. And there was an increase in the amount of women who needed to be, who called to be accompanied to the hospital for the rape kit. And what was interesting to me as a journalist who covered in Vancouver and in Whistler is there was a lot of alcohol in both places. But in Whistler, I did not feel unsafe. And I've covered a lot of Olympics. I've been a national team athlete, and I've been to many world championships. You can celebrate sport, or you can use sport as a way to celebrate male violence. Especially if you spend most of the emphasis on violent male sports, like I would say the way in which Canadian males play hockey. So Whistler, I interviewed the women from the Howe Sound Women's Shelter. They were very afraid that sexual violence would increase during the Olympics, and they worked with the businesses in Whistler. They had for the first time ever, they had an office right in Whistler, because they're located in Squamish. and they had a coaster and poster date rape campaign, and it turned out, they reported to me, that sexual assaults actually decreased. At least the women who came to them, the amount of women who came to them decreased during the Olympics, even though there were way more people and lots of alcohol. And then the next year I covered the World Cross Country Ski Championships in Oslo, and I skied up every day from town to the championships, and everyone was drinking. I mean, you know, thousands and thousands of people with lots and lots of alcohol. I skied back at night all by myself in the dark past hundreds and hundreds of guys drinking, never felt unsafe. I interviewed, I had a sports sociologist from university in Lillehammer interview the female Norwegian officer who did the annual report on sexual assaults in Norway. They have never found an increase in sexual assaults during a big sporting event like the cross-country skiing World Championships. So it's not because there is sport that the sexual assaults increased, and it's not because there's alcohol that the sexual assaults increased. It has to do with the celebration of male violence and using sport to celebrate male violence, and then basically, when you report on all these things, you decide that those increases are not part of your report. So when we go to UBC, who were paid a lot of money to make the Olympic, to write the Olympic Games impact study, which was supposed to be an objective and scientific study under, you know, anything to do with crime or discrimination, there's no mention of the fact that sexual assaults increased in District 1 by 233%. There's no mention that assaults increased during the Games, or that domestic violence calls increased, or that calls, you know, to assist with the rape kit increased. None of that exists in the official objective report on the Olympics. The next year, when the Stanley Cup riot report was written, there's nothing in there, even though you can get the information from the VPD website, that sexual assaults, police reported sexual assaults, that's a very tiny percentage, as we all know, of real the amount of sexual assaults. I looked at every month from 2002 on the VPD website. No month came as high as April and May 2011 in the build-up to the Stanley Cup playoffs. That is never mentioned. There's not one report, whether it's the, you know, the report that the provincial government did, or the city or the police did. There's no mention at all that there was an increase in sexual assaults, a significant increase too. So we need to look at the way in which the real experiences of women are completely made invisible as soon as anything becomes an official report.
Asha Chopska is an advocate and one of the directors of Justice for Girls.
I just want to come back to, you know, the systemic nature of police abuse of girls and women, and I absolutely agree that we're not talking about a few bad apples. I think we could talk about many incidents of violence by police against especially Aboriginal girls and women. You know, we could talk about the police officers in Prince George who allegedly were sexually exploiting teen Aboriginal girls. You know, obviously we can talk about ex-Judge Ramsey and his violent abuse of Aboriginal girls in Prince George. So we are talking about systemic problems within the criminal justice system. And here I think there's an opportunity for feminists in the Independent Investigations Office recently opened with Rosenthal leading the office. And as some of you know, the office is supposed to investigate on and off duty incidents of death and serious harm by police officers. So police perpetrated on and off duty incidents of death and serious harm, and sexual assault is not included. So police perpetrators' sexual assault is not included in the mandate of Rosenthal's office. And that is actually something that we really need to fight as feminists, and to make sure that that police perpetrated sexual assault is obviously recognized as a form of gravely serious harm to women, and that is discriminatory against women not to include sexual assault as a part of the mandate. So that's one thing I think that is a challenge or a fight for us. So.
Some participants in this roundtable expressed little or no confidence that the police or the state would ever be truly responsive to solving violence against women. They had some other ideas.
I think another tactic is to look more outside of the box and not rely on the state as much. We have a zine, it's called the 70% Solution. Sherry Smiley made it a couple years back. And it talks about different ways in which we can hold the men accountable, and it kind of goes with the title of the roundtable. I think we do need to name and shame the men who are committing the violence. I think it's important to label that it is mostly men committing violence against women. I think you do need to expose the racism in the attacks. Mm-hmm. Women are attacked not only because they're women, but because they're Native or because they're Asian or because... And it's important to, you can't separate the two in most cases, in that we know that men use their position in the world and the power that they have, whether that be money or access or race, in instances, and we need to interfere with that process, but also acknowledge that process at the same time. We've done, my favorite thing to do is postering campaigns. I absolutely love it. It worked really well with Tremblay. But I think it's important when the poster is to the man, not to the woman. I think we get enough warnings of what, where not to be, what not to do, what not to look like, who not to talk to. And I think it's much more, I think... engaging and stimulating to me to make it about the man. So who he is, how he gains access, who he's going after, what he looks like. So means, mode of operation, and exposing that to not only him, but to other men, that this is something we can do and it is something that we will do. And to use the media when possible and to engage the media when possible. I think there's other ways of doing it as well. Confrontations are a great way as well to hold men accountable. You gather up 20 women and you surround his house. It's pretty embarrassing, and it's a public stance, that's for sure. Or taking up his workplace, so interfering with the ways and how he gains access. And it's sometimes more satisfying than getting a charge that doesn't necessarily mean anything or going to impede his work or his life or his family. Like, just like to mess with them a bit.
I really love what you're saying. I was actually wanted to say that direct action is a good way to holding men accountable, like making noise at his home, or like identify the man publicly, like making a list of shame, or the exclusion of violent men and people who support them in your community. Or, you know, there's really multiple ways that can be violent, not violent, and intimate or collective action as the woman who have been violated want.
And that was Shani Hua, anarchist, feminist, and activist with a successful student revolt in Quebec. You've been listening to excerpts from a roundtable called Naming, Shaming, and Calling the Police. How Can We Hold Abusive Men Accountable? It was one of four feminist roundtables at an event honoring Canada's National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women, hosted by Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter in December 2012. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden in Vancouver, and this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Radio Re-